The best indicator for future success, adventure, is past success. Like, that's pretty much the only indicator. Not everyone is able to fundraise. So just the better entrepreneurs are going out to fundraise, and they are the ones that are selected, and not everybody's fundraising. So that's why we see, on average, better innovation. And in that analysis, we showed like that first-time funds are doing as well as second-time and third-time funds, if not even better.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to FinTech Leaders, coming to you from New York City. I'm your host, Miguel Armaza, and I'm a co-founder of Gilgamesh Ventures, a venture capital fund that backs early-stage fintech entrepreneurs in the U.S. and Latin America. If you enjoyed this conversation, I invite you to leave a review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your shows so more people can learn about FinTech Leaders. In this episode, I sit down with Asaf Horesh, managing partner of Vintage Investment Partners, a $4 billion global fund investing in VC funds, growth companies, and secondary investments. Founded in 2003, Vintage has invested in several of the world's leading venture funds and has exposure to over 2,000 technology companies. In this episode, we discuss going from Apache helicopter pilot to tech investor, why self-awareness and critical reflection are especially important to succeed in VC, how Vintage leverages data to make better investment decisions, why it makes sense to invest in first-time funds, succession planning for investment firms, and a lot more. Asaf, welcome to FinTech Leaders. You know, I got to say, this is probably the first time that I'm interviewing a former Apache helicopter pilot. So I want to hear about your background, because it's not all investing or fintech. You know, you have some more variety in your background.
Okay. First, thanks for having me. I'm happy to be the first, but it's just one part of my career. Obviously, a very big part of how I was brought up and what I learned and some of the key values that I walk with, and a lot of good people that I met and are still in my network, even during my current investing days. But yeah, excited to be here and thanks for inviting me.
Was that just a job for you to be an Apache helicopter pilot?
So I'm from Israel. In Israel, serving in the military is mandatory, and every man goes to serve for three years. I went to Flight Academy, and once I graduated, I signed up for much more than that. So I ended up serving as a pilot and as a soldier and an officer in the Air Force for 8 years. So from the age of 18 until I was 26. And then since we both went to Wharton, I spent my entire career up until like 2 years ago, post leaving the military up until 2 years ago, serving in reserves. So I would go to the Air Force once every week, or a day every week, or a couple of weeks to do my duties as a helicopter pilot, except for the 4 years that I spent in the US. So it was, I would say it was a job, but it was a mandatory job when I was a youngster. And then it was just part of my life, actually a big part of my life, even when I became like a businessman, an investor, a student, whatever, I was a father.
Tell us how that influenced your business career later on, right? Was there something about that training?
I think I would say maybe four things. The first one that the Israeli Air Force is very good at is debrief. Like, so while you go to Flight Academy, one of the soft skills that you are actually very much trained about is being very self-aware and be very critical of yourself and be very structured about it. It's like every action you do, you debrief yourself and you first look internally and then you look at the outside. Like, what did you do wrong? What did I do wrong? And how can I be better? And I think when I'm speaking to a lot of people in the industry, in the venture ecosystem, I just think when I look across board, people that are very much self-aware and very critical of themselves and can look at their own mistakes are becoming much better investors much faster. Because a lot of people fall in love with stuff that they do, even though they make mistakes. And it's very hard to admit that you made a mistake. So people that are taking that kind of deep brief capability, even if they were trained on or not, are becoming much faster, much quicker. I actually think this is true across business. Doesn't have to do, right? Over all aspects of your life, even being a father and a husband and a son, like if you admit what you did wrong and you can improve yourself, then you're becoming better faster. I'd say the other thing is teamwork is super important. Even though pilots are very much trained to be solo, you still realize that the power on the team is much greater than the power of the individual. So knowing what you're good at, what your co-pilot is good at, what your wingman is good at, what your squadron is good at, then it's super important to try to amplify those capabilities. So that's number two. And I think number three, which is in what me, which might be the most important, is to take everything in perspective. Like, we're venture is tough and it's a job and tech is not easy, but we're whole hand, like, it's great. People are literally doing much more risky and important stuff, and we're trying to do good and trying to have fun every day we do and trying to be as good as we can. Just putting stuff in perspective is always important.
I want to zoom in a little bit on your first point, and I guess that's tied to self-awareness and also reflecting on kind of your past mistakes. I think in sports, this is very easy to see because you watch the replay and you watch yourself, right? How have you seen the best investors, maybe the best managers that you work with, apply that in their investing lives?
So I would say, by the way, in the Air Force, it's the same like in sports. Like, you literally, everything is, there is like movies and clips and everything is recorded. So you can go and look back and say, hey, this is what I did here, and so on and so forth. So it's much easier than real life. But I think first there is like the process, right? So I would say definitely people that apply a process and say, let's either grade ourselves or walk through what have we done, what have we done good, what have we done bad, and share this with other people, mostly internally, like within their funds, right? So you'd go, like, there is a once in a quarter, once in every couple of quarters or whatever, and I will go through my entire portfolio and say, hey, these are the companies, this was the investment thesis, this is what happened right, this is what happened wrong, where could I have done a better job? Like, I didn't read the market, I didn't read the team, whatever. So when you have that type of process internally within the fund, it's significantly better than not having a process at all, right? So just putting the process in place so that you can debrief and improve. That also, I think, at least for us at Vintage, that sort of stabilizes a very much culture of self-awareness. Like, the partners coming to the entire investment team and sharing with them our own failures, right? So this is what we expect everybody to do, but this is first and foremost what we expect ourselves to do, right? Share our own failures and what we can do better. So other people not only can learn from our mistakes, but also feel comfortable sharing their own mistakes, right? So that's one thing. I would say externally, it's not super easy, but when I meet with a manager or like a GP or a partner or a principal or an associate, whatever, of a fund, I think it typically takes me not too long to figure out, are they very much self-aware or are they what I would call like a salesperson? And to be frank, most people are in love with their companies. That's part of the ethos, right? So you have to fall in love with your investments. Otherwise, you will never do any investment. But once you did that, it's better to be very critical and very transparent about like what's going right and what's going wrong in order to be more helpful for the company and for your own kind of interest as well. So I would say having the process internally, and then when you communicate externally, also, at least for someone like me or for someone like Vintage, very important to be transparent and balanced and not being very salesy.
In your opinion, can self-awareness be taught?
Very tough question. I'm thinking on the process I went through in Flight Academy, right? So this was like a very much kind of a heavy educational exercise. I think I came in relatively with good self-awareness. So probably yes, but I would say you probably have to have like the ingredients in your personality to be able to be taught that. But again, most people don't go through the training that I went through, and still some are very much self-aware and some are very much not self-aware. But maybe the last point I would say, like, it also comes with maturity, right? So once you mature and you realize what's really more important in life, a lot of people, I would say, more self-aware, or at least reflect on that better.
So Asaf, I think even hearing you the last 10 minutes, this comes out as evident, but when we spoke in the past, you mentioned that at Vintage, you guys are data freaks. You like to analyze data and understand kind of what that's telling you. Can you share your approach to analyzing all the data that you have collected over the last 10 years? And also, I'm sure you're looking for at outside data.
Yeah. So I would say first Vintage, we celebrated 20 years last summer. So the fund was actually established at the end of the dot-com bubble. If you think 20 years afterwards, like maybe similar time, we have a chart that shows like what happened in the dot-com bubble in terms of capital inflows into the market and how it's going up and down, which is very similar to what's happening today to a scary degree. But I would say when my partners started Vintage, the concept behind it was like everybody wanted to sell their positions. And they said like, we will go long when other people are going short because we believe long-term in this sector. But more so, not only that, but also we will start doing this in Israel. And Israel, because it's so tiny, like literally 10, 20 miles north and south of Tel Aviv, you cover almost 90% of Israeli startups. If some of the listeners haven't met Israelis, then they should, but like Israelis love to talk. So when they went to meet the companies themselves, like they started collecting the data, right? So they would literally collect every piece of information they could. They would type in the notes and they started saving all this information. And the reason for that is, I'm giving maybe a long context to answer the question, but it's important to understand how we work. And the reason for collecting all of that data is twofold. One, a lot of venture funds are very much focused on a specific sector or a specific stage or a specific sector and are the intersection of a sector and a stage. So if you're a seed investor, you would meet an entrepreneur probably one time in your life, and then you have to decide whether you're going to invest or not. And coincidentally, you might meet that entrepreneur again if she comes back to raise like in a decade from now. But that's like you have one data point to decide based on. For us, our business model has always been, even when we did secondaries, could have been like for a very long time. So every in-between rounds, with rounds, mid-stage, late stage. And so this was the DNA of Vintage from basically day zero. So that's the ethos, and that's how we started collecting. So today we started as a secondary fund in Israel. Today we have secondary fund, growth fund, and a fund of funds across Europe, US, and Israel. So we're covering more than 20,000 companies, many, many hundreds of managers, and we're collecting all of this data for more than 20 years now. So we have one of the largest data sets in the venture ecosystem, very much structured. The other reason is that it's between funny and sad to say, is we as investors are very much preaching to companies to use their data. Obviously, now we're investing a lot in data and AI, but we haven't seen a lot of managers using their data, leveraging it to make better investments. So when think about like for us, the business model kind of is always, it's sort of a circle of information that kind of flows in and out. And we're leveraging it both internally. So we're getting a lot of signals and data points from the ecosystem, both from managers, corporates, I haven't talked about our value add, and from the companies themselves, right? And all flows in. And it also, we are sort of freaks, not only of data, but also from having an objective view. So we would go and meet the companies ourselves. So meet dozens of companies. Our team is pretty large. We have 15 people on our investment team. So I mean, dozens of companies ourselves. And this all flows into our database such that when we go and meet a manager or a company, we already have the history or all the signals and data points that we had on this thing. I would say we've built now, we have almost more than 10 people in our data team, just internally at Vintage. And it's a very much kind of, I don't say high end, but like, think about like a startup and their own data team, like anything from operations to data analysts and all the tech stack that would be in a good startup with open source and whatnot. And we've invested a lot of capital to build this team such that like in a few clicks, you can see a lot of KPIs on funds and companies and all the structured and unstructured data is very much available. And I still think we're in the early innings for ourselves in how we can build that and how we can leverage that to make better investments.
Given your institutional knowledge about the aftermath of the dot-com boom, what and the parallels that you see today, what should we expect for the next few years?
So I have sort of a deck that I'll go through and I explain what we've seen in the past few years and what are the similarities to the dot-com bubble and what are the differences. I think in terms of capital inflows, it's very much similar. So if you look at the rise of capital inflow in 2000, it's very, like the chart is literally almost identical to what happened in 2021. And then if you look at the 2 years following that in terms of like the capital, like the decline in capital inflows, the decline is very much similar to 22 and 23. So if you extrapolate what we've seen from the 2000 boom to what we've seen in the 2021 boom, after 2 years, it sort of stabilizes, right? So like we're back in the old new normal. We are also seeing this already in the trends, like in the quarterly trends. We're already seeing for past 3, 4, 5 quarters, very much sort of a stabilization. It's more so in the mid stage and the later stage. And it's still going in, like it's still trickling down into the earlier stage. So we still haven't stabilized in the earlier stages, but mid and late stage are pretty much same level as they were before 2020. So that's one thing. The other thing I'll say is maybe two more things. Like M&As haven't sort of M&A and the IPO window has been closed for 2 years. It takes 2 to 3 years before the M&A market and the IPO window rebound. So hopefully within a year or so, we will start seeing more M&As and the IPO market will open. You know, from my sheer perspective, it's like past trends. And also, we're seeing the expectations are pretty much getting aligned slowly but surely. And then the last thing that I would say, and that's an optimistic view, post-downturns, we've seen a lot of innovation traditionally in the past, and also obviously a much better environment for investors to invest in, right? So the two reasons for the first thing is that not everyone is able to fundraise. So just the better entrepreneurs are going out to fundraise and they are the ones that are selected and not everybody is fundraising. So that's why we see on average better innovation, tougher market for better entrepreneurs. So that's on that. And obviously like the supply demand is very different. So the entry prices for the venture funds is much more attractive than it was like in 2020, 21, 22. But so if you look, this is Cambridge Associates data. If you look at the past cycle in 2008, so vintages of funds leading to that funds, to that cycle, to this downturn were like the top quartile were doing shy of 2x net. And the vintages of the funds coming out of that downturn, 2010, 11 and 12, their top quartile was almost 4x net. So it's like literally 2x uplift in performance. So hopefully, like, the next few years are the ones to be very aggressive in as investors.
Let's zoom in a little bit on that, on your fund of fund strategy. Correct me if I'm wrong, but you went from having more of a generalist fund of fund strategy to now investing in industry-focused GPs, right? So for fintech, you would back a fund that invests in fintech. For healthcare, you would do the same. Maybe share a bit about that strategy.
Yeah, so I'll say in general, we're money managers, right? And we're managing pension funds, capital, and large institutions and insurance companies. So we take this very seriously. And our first and foremost goal is to generate the best returns we can. How we do this? So initially, on the fund-to-fund strategy, I'm sure you know, and most listeners know this, and if they know, don't they should. Like, the best indicator for future success at venture is past success. Like, that's pretty much the only indicator. And it's very simple to understand because the best founders literally pick the funds that they will let them invest in. So access is like the core thing at venture, and best entrepreneurs pick the best funds. So that's the only indicator. And so traditionally, to your question, we've always looked at the generalist model because these were the best funds. And there were very few funds that had large enough markets to target. And like, if you are a fintech fund, for example, and we'll get to fintech for a second, there are also fintech investors in generalist funds. So why would someone take your capital and not a generalist partner that is investing specifically in a specific sector? What we found is two things. One, that some verticals, sectors became large enough such that you can generate outside return just being focused on that specific sector. The other thing that we found out in the past few years is that specific sectors required a lot of expertise from investors, right? So you, before we get into fintech, so for example, in healthcare, like, you literally need to understand how the US healthcare system works in order to be able to invest in that field. Otherwise, like, you're going to lose a lot of capital. So that not only is important from an investor perspective, that's also very important from an entrepreneur perspective. So entrepreneurs were seeking investors that really understand their field and are not generalist investors. So that made us figure out, like, that, you know, even to generate returns, like, we should go to specific vertical funds. So for example, in fintech in the US, we back Ribbit and Better Tomorrow Ventures. So that's kind of in the fintech sector. And then in healthcare, we have actually a verticalized fund of fund for healthcare, but that's a very kind of, it's a different story. But we do have, we're now, to generate best returns, we're not only thinking generalist terms, we're also thinking, like, what are the sectors that we need some to have more exposure and can generate outside return?
Yeah, I mean, I'm biased, but I definitely agree with what you're describing. Specialization is key, especially in some sectors. And how do you think about emerging managers? Some of these great funds that you're talking about, at some point, they had to raise their fund one or fund two and so forth. What is your philosophy at Vintage around emerging managers?
So it's really important to define what emerging manager is. We have a very strict definition to what we call emerging manager. We actually have a sleeve within our fund of fund that is called breakout managers, which can be interpreted to emerging managers as well. I'll start from the fact that I think investing is a profession. And in order to be a good investor, and that goes back to debriefing and all everything that we spoke about at the beginning, you have to try. You have to try and you have to fail and sometimes you succeed and whatnot. And it takes time to build your resume and your investment acumen. And so we, as Vintage, I think we're privileged to the sense that we don't invest in first-time investors. We definitely invest in first-time funds. So when we look at, literally, I was sending like an analysis that we've done on first time funds this morning to one of the key members in an investment committee of one of our largest LPs. And they were asking me, would you invest in first-time funds? Because we don't invest in first-time funds. And in that analysis, we showed like that first-time funds are doing as well as second-time and third-time funds, if not even better, at least for in our data set. And the reason is that a lot of the times, first-time funds are smaller than second-time and third-time funds. And being small is good for returns. So as my partner says, size is the enemy of returns in venture. So that's one thing. The way we do this is actually back to our conversation about data and tracking and people and whatnot. So when we invest in a fund, we actually model it by partner. We would say who sourced the deals, who led the due diligence, who sits on the board. And then over time, we have a thesis on specific investors within funds such that when they spin out, then we already know their track record and we know them and we've had the communication with them and we think they're self-aware and we think they're responsible. And we, the only bet that we're doing is that their name is good enough brand to at least start the firm and they will know how to manage the capital. So that's sort of it. And funny enough, yesterday we literally in our IC made two commitments to people in their first funds. Like, so in fund ones. So I think that's the cycle of this industry, right? So people come and go and that's what we do. Like the whole concept of if we do a good enough job, we are the first to know that, or one of the first to know that a really good partner is leaving or a really good investor is starting their own fund.
It's very similar to what good VCs, in my opinion, do, which is to track the best employees, the best contributors of either companies within your portfolio or outside of your portfolio. If the CTO of like a very interesting fintech company leaves and they decide to build a company, if you've been tracking them for a long time, it's going to be an easy decision.
Yeah. So, and then there is the other decision that they need to decide to take your capital, right? So not only being able to track them, but also build the relationship such that they will think about you as a long-term investor, a value-add investor, a good person that they trust and want to work with for a long time. That's our business. It's fun because when I speak to investors, a lot of time they ask me like, what's important? What are the ingredients to be a good investor? And I'm like, when I started, I thought it's about being analytical, understanding finance, understanding tech, you know, understanding strategy. And I felt like, you know, I went to Wharton, I was at BCG, I'm pretty good with numbers. Like I did computer science, bachelor's in computer science. I know something. And then it took me maybe a couple of months to figure out like, these are all nice to haves. It's a people's business, right? So people need to feel that you're the person they want to work with and they trust and vice versa. That's how it works. And then being able to analyze that, it's all important, but it's a nice to have.
I like that a lot. Asav, you have an interesting model at Vintage because, as you mentioned, you're not only doing fund of funds, you have secondaries, and you also have a growth direct investing strategy into companies. But the team, you know, is structured, each investing team within Vintage is structured by vertical, right? So one professional is doing all three for one vertical. What drove you to that strategy?
So that's how we started. And then it worked for us. But that's the truth. But I think actually we're very nimble and dynamic and we would have changed it if we thought it made more sense. I think essentially when whatever underwriting you do for fund to fund or secondary or a growth, the underlying asset is the company, right? So when I look at a fintech fund, I better understand what are the value drivers and why they are value drivers, right? So in order to understand that, I have to understand something about fintech. What are the trends? Who are the important stakeholders? Who are the people that I need to talk to understand if it's interesting? Are these teams top-notch? Did they come out of the best fintechs or best financial companies? And they were stars, right? So to do that, like, it doesn't important if I'm analyzing a fund for a primary investment, if I'm analyzing a fund for a secondary investment, or if I'm analyzing a company for either growth or secondary. So that's that. And that goes back to the discussion we had about generalists and verticals, even for someone like us, which is like, you know, as to some extent an LP and a GP, we do need to understand the sectors that we work in. And for us, I think we figured out like it's easier to specialize in a sector for the better of the team than specialize in specific underwriting. What it also creates is very sort of a seamless data flow within our team. So we don't have an IC for a fund of fund and an IC for a secondary. So if there is a fund that we really like or a company that we really like, these are the same people around the table. Like, and we all hear all the signals and data points coming to us about those funds and companies around the same table on the same team.
Do you think you need people around the table, you know, that have different talent or more expanded, I guess, talents or outlook as someone who's doing only VC or only direct investing, you know, or only fund of fund? Or could you train, you know, any great LP to do what you guys do?
So two key themes. One is we've never hired a partner at Vintage. So my partner who started the firm, Alan, he started as a partner. He's the only one in the 20-some years of Vintage that started as a partner. Everyone starts from within and grows through the ranks. So I would say we have a very specific model, and I think more so we have a very specific culture. So it takes time to understand how we do business and how we do investments, and we train people along the way. The other thing I'll say is that we're very much into diversity. It's super important for us, and I think it makes us better. It's not just gender, it's also religion and ethnicity and also various backgrounds. So some people here are coming with banking experience. Some people here are coming from being lawyers. Some people here came from consulting firms. Some people here came with operational tech background. So overall, I think that's the mix that we're looking for. Having said that, like, you know, our job is not rocket science. Like, it's a job. And I was laughing about it. Like, you know, we always have requirements that are more than what we actually need. But we're looking for good people that are humble and hard workers and team, very good at teamwork.
You mentioned your founder, Alan. The last fund was raised without him in the mix. Talk about fund succession. It's probably one of the hardest things to get right. And even for extremely large asset managers, we see it and we see them stumble. I want to know more about this.
Yeah, so I would say I give Alan 99% credit on this transition, this process, whatever. And it's really hard. The reason I know it's hard is because we're tracking funds and we just see how hard it is, right? And I think what he saw in his first 15 years in the business was that also from his self-experience is that a lot of funds fail in this process and there is no continuation. So about 7 years ago, to his credit, he went on and interviewed a lot of fund managers that were successful at doing this transition and the succession process and laid out like a plan of what's going to happen in the next years. And then I think 4 years ago, we decided within the GP, so we were four GPs, that we will sign an agreement that is very open and transparent, and we will communicate it out to our LPs as well on what we're going to do and how it's going to happen. And there was a lead up to that stage, right? So it's not like someone was surprised that we're going to do this thing. So we signed an agreement that basically this agreement, the key clause there says that at the age of 62, you're not part of raising new vehicles at Vintage, which means when I get to be 62, I will stop being part of new funds raised after that. And that what happened last year. So he was 62 last year. He looks much younger than this. But this was sort of the time, the transition when me and my partner A became managing partners and we went out with our partners, other partners to raise our fourth growth fund. And he's a small LP in the fund, but he will not be part of the IC and the GP and the management company on that fund. And yeah, this, like, as I said, like, I very much admired the leadership he took in that process. And I think it's really hard for founders and key stakeholders in France to do this process because they feel it's theirs. And I can just say we still have a lot to prove ourselves, and it's always a new day and you need to prove new stuff. But I think for founders and GPs and managing partners that want to have continuation to their brands and funds, and you know, they were entrepreneurs and they've built their businesses, it's just important to be super transparent and super clear on what the process is with the people that you want to succeed. And that kind of, it worked well for us. And as I mentioned, still a lot to prove.
It sounds like having that rules-based approach definitely help. Like there's a formula at 62, this is what happens. Were there other rules that you set out as part of the process?
Not really. I think it's very important to have these rules and have this transparency, both internally and externally, and communicate it both ways. It goes back to culture and the people that you want to work with. I feel like we've built internally between the partners a very strong circle of trust, I will call it, and friendship, such that we want the best for each other. And it's not like we're not super competitive and whatnot, but I think within the partnership, it's like when you get to that process, you have to have like a very strong level of trust and friendship. And it goes both ways, right? So we see, I have a lot of friends in other funds that I see. I have a lot of peers in other funds that were coming. Like I didn't join as a partner. I joined as a principal and I grew up the ranks, and like I to some extent, I proved myself and whatnot. I did some good deals, some bad deals, whatnot to a lot of my peers or in similar positions in other funds. And it goes both ways. You have to have the trust and you have to have the understanding that a lot of the economics, everybody needs to let go at some point. Both ways, by the way. So I would say it's not only rule-based, it's also very much about culture and trust and friendship.
Asif, this has been very interesting, honestly. I've taken good notes and I'm sure people are going to learn from it. Thanks for joining, you know, amidst this chaotic times, but I do appreciate you stopping by and sharing a little bit of your wisdom and everything you've done.
Thank you. I would just say, first, thanks for taking the time and inviting me. And this has been like a really interesting conversation. I liked it a lot. Hopefully this was helpful to a lot of people. The other thing I'll say is, I hope in a few years from now, we'll look back at this period of time, which is hectic and a lot of conflict in the region. We'll say this was a point in time and we're now past it. And I took the time on purpose because I think it's important, and it's also important to show resilience during this time. And this is what we do.
Absolutely. Step by step. Thank you, Asif.
All right. Thanks, Miguel. Have a great one.
Thanks for tuning in. I hope you enjoyed this great episode with Asif from Vintage Investment Partners. If you want more interviews, make sure to subscribe, follow, and leave a review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your shows. It helps and truly means a lot. And if you have any suggestions or thoughts about the show, just drop me a line on Twitter or LinkedIn. Signing off till next week, I'm your host, Miguel Armas.